Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And I have Angeline, as promised, I have her back on the show. So actually, just so you know, this will actually be airing this Monday. And what I wanted to basically kind of do as a precursor, as a lead-in, because I just talked about on Friday about the difference between leaders and managers. And a manager, when they learn something or when they're told something, they do the right thing, and that's what they do. A leader actually either, you know, learns, is this the right thing? Or they challenge what they're doing, and they'll actually stand away or step out and go, I shouldn't be doing this. This is wrong. And as a matter of fact, the Milgram experiment kind of exposes how people really struggled. They wanted to back away, but they still did what they're told. Those were managers. Only a leader, and not a lot of people are leaders. And what I'd like to say, but just due to the fact that you, Angeline, have actually started really asking, I want to have the information so that I can make my own decision. Because I'm not here telling you, you got to do this. But the fact is that you are seeking what to do is the right thing so that you can make the right choice. That to me is leadership material.
Okay.
And so, folks, we've got a future leader, if not already a leader, on those things, because you're already leading on correct principles. The Soulless Society. I've not seen or heard any news on your book.
It's out there now. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, and it's called Soulless Society, The Ultimate Deception That Took the Land of Plenty to a Nation of Death.
There you have it, folks. And so we'll get that information from you. Just email it to me, and I'll get all of that up so that they know where to go. I'm sure that did you create a domain for your book or for your publishing?
SoulessSocietyBook.com.
There you go.
So it's just SoulessSocietyBook.com.
Awesome, because that's what good book writers do. See, I didn't do that. Anyway, I won't talk about my failings. Last time you were on, we were talking about Republic Review, and you reminded me what the question was that I didn't answer, but I'll let you ask it again.
So I asked you, what is the timeline for the Republic Review process? About how long does it take to do this?
So since it's never really been done, I can't give you empirical data on, well, this is exactly what we expect. And I don't think you can even simulate this. I believe that America, there's so many people that have been misled. I was listening to a Jefferson Airplane song. I don't know if you remember that, but it's about don't you need somebody to love? And basically, there's this line that says, when the truth is told, you know, and everything that we've been told has been lies, then, you know, it really wakes us up. And I believe that America is kind of in that image that song is kind of conveying, that I believe most people have started to recognize that our government has not been our friend in a long time.
I agree. There's still a lot of people sleeping, but I'm very happy to see the amount of people that I run into just on a daily basis that are actually waking up.
And, you know, there have been people on the left that kind of were early out. Like, I don't know if you remember Jim Carrey when he was talking about vaccines back in the 90s. And I was going, wow, you know, that's really out there, but the empirical data is actually proven over time. I mean, a long time ago, I realized he was right, but because he was a leftist, or I perceived him as a leftist, as a Canadian socialism, because he does have left-leaning predilections. I mean, he kind of wants socialism. He wants government and the nanny state to do those things. And I go, okay, So we have to start kind of wading through all of the lies, because he's realized the pharmaceutical lie before I did. And mm-hmm. as a matter of fact, I worked with a doctor that was actually the pharmaceutical corporations ruined her and her practice because she refused to tote the line. And so, and she's not an outlier. There are others out there like that. And it's just like, oh my gosh, you know, it's how bad is it? And it's far worse than anybody really wants to realize. And so this is my conundrum, that what do we do? Do we have to teach everybody, you know, how and why all of these things happened? Or do we, or can we finally just quickly get to the point? We've got to do something now. We got to save this republic, right? I mean, when somebody's been in an accident, do we really want to ask, well, okay, what caused the accident? Because a person's dying.
Mm-hmm.
Let's save the republic, and then we can do the due diligence and looking everything up. But to answer your question, I think that if we actually started a movement, it would probably take, in a dark red state, like I honestly thought Wyoming could do this in 2 years, within 2-3 year cycle, because you have to have a full election cycle go through this if you actually created the movement. Because the Republican Party, this is the only state in the union where the Republican Party absolutely endorses the Republican review process. We've done videos. If you notice, we actually have the Republican Party logo there. And so I worked with them on the committee. And if we could get them to actually start supporting the petitions and changing out their county commissioners and demand that their counties retain or restore their representation in the Senate and restore that state government, I believe that it would be very quick, because they would set that example. And have you ever heard of the second man theory?
No.
So we have a couple of states that are out there that, you know, are being, you know, awakened. And if we have Wyoming, or let's say South Dakota, because that's the other state that's really coming along, because those are the two states where we've introduced the legislation, getting people to actually have these conversations. And so if Wyoming does it, then I think South Dakota would quickly stand up, and vice versa. And so what ends up happening, and you see this all the time, and this is sometimes planned as a manipulation, and then sometimes it's actually synergistic. One person stands up and says, we can't do this anymore. We got to stop this. And I'm not doing it. They throw off their uniform or whatever, and they, you know, they take a direction. They make a choice. And then somebody else says, I'm with them, and does that. As after that second man, it becomes, you know, just almost like contagious. Everybody's, yeah, me too. Because once the second person validates what has been said and what needs to be done, it just, boom, it just becomes logical for, and everybody gets caught up in that moment. And I don't know if you've ever seen that. They use that a lot in like football, but it happens in politics as well. And a lot of times in politics, it's a part of manipulation. That second person is ready to go. And as a matter of fact, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison used that with the Kentucky Resolution, because they actually communicated. And Jefferson said, I will do this and you do that. And so the second man responded in kind, even though it was 2 months later, or about a month and a half later. It's still, you know, they got a second, you know, state to stand up. So it actually probably gave more credence to the other states. What the heck's going on here? This didn't just come from Kentucky. Now Virginia's on board with this. What's going on? And
right.
It forced them to actually have to address this. And so, you know, I'm using a good reason why sometimes you want to do this. Sometimes lying or manipulation is good. Like parents conspiring to get their kids a gift or to do something really good for their kids. Sometimes they have to lie and conspire. And so the word conspiracy doesn't exist in just evil terms, even though the connotation and the way it's defined, it does. And, you know, even though the angels or the plan, because, you know, God has a plan and it's secret. Is that a conspiracy? Yes. But is it an evil conspiracy? There you go.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
because it's a secret. If we knew what the plan was, then it would be exploited, or we would be, you know, we would pervert it. And so anyway,
that's for sure.
And we have that predilection. So back to the timeline. I would think that it would probably take, if people really committed, if we had a statewide like Wyoming actually get committed, where the county central committees as the party started using these petitions. And the more petitions you have, in other words, the more ammo that you can fire at your county commissioners and up to your state and your state, you know, leadership, the more people get educated and start recognizing how bad it really is. You know, if you only complain about, you know, this one thing that they're doing, like raising taxes, and nobody likes it, but they're not willing to start throwing people off the bus. But when they realize it's not just taxes, it's they're taking their land with the carbon, you know, the CO2 pipelines that they're building. All of these things, all the agendas that are, you know, being forced down their throat, when you place context to all of that, that these guys are the ones that could stop it, then all of a sudden people go, hey, you know, you don't deserve to be in office anymore. And in Wyoming, there's a likelihood that some of these people would actually be forced by the pressure. And I don't mean to say this in a derogatory, you know, because you remember Shepard? I forget his first name, but do you remember the Shepard case?
Yes.
Okay. So the Shepard case was completely blown out of proportion because, bottom line, they thought it was an anti-homosexual, you know, murder or a hate crime, when it was actually something else. Because the reality is, and I talked to a guy that actually lived in that area, he was a radio show host, and it really came down to a drug deal that went bad. And so, you know, oh, well, because there was this association, they made this. But my point is, because I lived in Colorado and I haven't lived in Wyoming, but I know the mind model. And I understand that, you know, sometimes you get this, you know, justice. You know, people become, you know, motivated to take care of things. There was a communist radio show host. It wasn't a communist radio show host. Yeah, well, there actually was, and he got shot. But there was a pedophile that they were looking for that had been molesting and actually took a girl and had her captured in an outhouse, you know, one of those porta potties. And so she was locked up in that, and they caught the girl on his property in this porta potty. I mean, they had him dead to rights, and he was hung just instantly. In other words, it was a lynching, and I don't know if they caught anybody. I forget the circumstances beyond that, but I go, wow. I mean, that doesn't happen in every state. Mm-hmm. And but that's, you know, these people, if they realize you're stealing from them, as a matter of fact, Aristotle in his book Politics, and I like using that book as a reference, he talks about the two reasons why people revolt against their government is, one, if they're starving. In other words, if they're being adversely affected to where they're looking at their own mortality in their eyes, or when they realize the government is stealing their wealth and their future. And that's what we have right now. We don't have, you know, this fact that we're starving. The government has never really gone down that path like old governments of old, where, you know, they would actually take care of everything. The fact is that I believe that as everybody starts to realize, and when you start reading these petitions, and we got a lot to do. I mean, I need some help doing this, and that's why I'm getting help. But, you know, everybody's busy. We all have good excuses, folks. I don't know how you're going to be able to tell your grandchildren or be able to tell your own children, if you're that young, you know, why we're living under a communist rule when you could have taken the time to help. And if they start understanding, they start hearing the truth, or maybe your great-great-grandchildren realize it, and they look and go, you know, I didn't see anything in my family doing this. Why didn't they get involved? We don't have to live the life of regret. All we have to do is start making the right choices and apply a little bit of time. Do we need to go to the football game? Do we need to attend the Circus Maximus? Whatever the entertainment that Caesar's putting on, Let's put it aside. This nation needs us now. But so back to the timeline, I think we could see it in 3 years in Wyoming, and I think we would see it in the next state probably 2 years later. And I honestly believe that before 10 years is up, we would actually, because at that point in time, as soon as they see two states moving in that direction, the federal government will start facing the shenanigan wheel and going, what can we do? And they'll start frustrating this, and that'll actually incite more states. And I believe that this will actually spread pretty quickly to where, when I say 10 years, I believe 10 years we will be done. Because as soon as one state, let me just say this, as soon as one state stands up and says, this debt is a facade, this is all fraud and you're defrauding the American people, and as soon as everybody learns how this is true, then all of a sudden we're going to find that people are going to go, you know what, we can't allow them to, you know, to actually play these shenanigans. Every country that has been basically buying up our debt, like China, they're doing it to undermine us. They know that the United States government doesn't have the authority to take money and spend it on things they don't have the authority to do. It's all fraud. And so when these other countries come back, if we actually win and we actually go down this path, they're going to try to make hay out of this, and we will be able to prove to the world how they knew. They had to have known. They were culpable in trying to destroy us. So, as I look at it, I honestly, because only God knows how long this will take, I would say that for creating critical mass, because once one state stands up, that's when critical mass starts to occur. Once we hit 13 states, though, this is kind of an interesting number, that when we hit 13 states, it kills the convention at that point in time. Because when you have 13 states that demand full enforcement of the Constitution, in other words, they're not looking for amendments. They want the federal government into compliance on the Constitution. So if you send us amendments, we're not going to have anything to do with it. Because the only way an amendment can be passed is if you have 38 states. So once you have that one extra state on the, we're not going to allow it to happen, then the 37 states won't do it. Does that make sense? So
yeah.
So the 13 will be a critical number. And then once we get to whatever that next, you know, because it'll change based on what states come on board due to representation in the House of Representatives. Now, if we had, you know, a few states, we could actually do this with a minority if California was a dark red conservative constitution-loving state. And same thing with Texas and New York, but they're not. The population centers have gone communist. But as I looked, the last time I looked at this, it would only take 27 states to actually get Republic Review to a point where they would be able to force the full federal government into compliance. So how long would it take to get there? I honestly think that the miracles can happen. As a matter of fact, when we look at how long it took for the revolution and everything else, it didn't take 10 years. 5 years, maybe 6 years. It didn't take that long. As soon as people started realizing that there was a resistance, which started up in Massachusetts, right? In Concord, when the British tried to exercise a little extra oomph, you know, to, you know, reel in those Puritans. And all of a sudden the rest of the state started waking up, which the Declaration of Independence, the following year came out. We, you know, it was done. We're fighting and we're going to become independent states. And by, what was it, 1783, the Articles of Confederation, I believe that's when the Treaty of Versailles was signed too. So, yeah, it didn't take long. Maybe, I think it may have been 1781 where the fighting had stopped or something like that. I'd have to look at all the history of that. But, you know, when George Washington walked in and kind of, you know, ended the war, but it wasn't 10 years. And we're talking about the world's empire. We're not talking about Spain or France. We're talking about the world's greatest empire. And they came back. They weren't done. As a matter of fact, they never relinquished. They never did. That's one of the reasons why they were so active in supporting the southern states with the Civil War and created so much debt that they said, now we own you. And when those states came back into the Union, by the grace of the 14th Amendment, it basically kept Britain from ever getting paid back until they corrupted our politicians just a few years later with the Organic Act. And that's how they did it. That's how they were able to get their funding and taking control, by using money. So anyway.
Now, I remember, I think it was when we were talking in one of the programs on the 14th Amendment, you had asked me a question about what would I do, and I don't remember what the exact scenario was, but the answer you were that you thought I would say is that I would sue the person or sue somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking over your the bulleted list for the Republic Review,
right,
in it, you know, how it says the Constitution does not grant authority to Supreme Court president or Congress to ratify the Constitution or the authority to amend the Constitution.
Right.
And that they're not principal parties to the compact.
That's
so
right.
I heard you and Paul, and at the very end of one of the programs, you started to talk about the courts, and I don't know exactly what you were going to say, but I guess my general question would be, it appears that the courts are able to flex their muscle through their decisions, even though they're not necessarily always based on what I don't know what other word to say other than true law, that it's more their interpretation. So how do we fight that through Republic Review, or do we?
Well, so what we have to do is we have to help people understand that the court is one of the biggest parts of the problem. They have been the enablers, and they have been the reinforcers. When the federal government does something like Obamacare, the court had to figure out how they could legitimize it with some fancy, you know, legal speak to say, oh, well, because it's a tax. And yeah, the federal government could create an excise tax, but they can't provide services and then say, well, that's a tax. That's not. Obamacare was not a tax. Baked into it was a penalty that they called a tax. If you're not going to do this, and bottom line, everything that Robert said was a huge lie. But the reality is, here we had 26 states that sued the federal government over Obamacare because they believed, because they're all lawyers, and they believe that everything has to be done, and they want to keep it in the court, and that's because that's where they make their money. The court is a money machine. This is where people get rich. And so when we look at lawyers, I mean, they're some of the most affluent, and they get into law and so forth. Anyway, the court's jurisdiction, as far as the federal court goes, their jurisdiction is limited to the enumerated objects. In other words, their jurisdiction extends to all things arising under this Constitution, and all laws that are made under their authority, or all laws that are made in pursuance. In other words, if the law is in pursuance to the Constitution, then it's under their authority. Now, when they created Obamacare, it wasn't in the pursuance of that power to regulate. See, they started reaching into all of these different things like commerce. Oh, well, they can regulate the commerce in the states. No, the Constitution's really clear on that, too. They can regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the states. They cannot regulate commerce within a state. It's only among the states, how states interact with each other. And where in the heck did they get the authority to actually start regulating corporations? Ah, well, that door got opened with the 16th Amendment and the judge's decision to say corporations are people. They didn't even have jurisdiction over that. So this is why when you really look at Republic Review, there's a lot more that we have to start looking at as far as what is the problem. You know, the problem just isn't that they're exercising powers. Some of the sources of the powers that they've exercised and are exercising come from judicial decisions where they've redefined the Constitution. It fundamentally, in contract law, the parties determine what those lines mean. The subcontractor, the entity that you create to exercise those objects that you, okay, you're going to mow my lawn. Let's go down this path and say, I'm going to mow your lawn and you give me general powers, right? So you say, I'm hiring you to make my yard the most beautiful yard and as far as the eye can see throughout our community, you know, in the best reaches of the good state of Florida, you know, not just down in the neighborhood, but you want to have the most beautiful yard. And you say, do whatever it takes, and here's the keys to my house, and you take off on a 2-week vacation, and you come back, and you're absolutely blown away at how beautiful your yard is. And it, you know, I was able to do a lot of things because I had streamlined everything to make it so easy to get all of this work done. And you're absolutely blown away because everybody was telling you it's going to take months to do that. Then when you get into your house and you realize that all your furniture is gone and nothing but hardware and tools and my equipment and everything else is being housed in your garage and in your house so that I don't have to import, you know, bring these things to the site. I have them right there. So now I can do all of this work without having to, you know, do the transportation, unloading and offload, taking them back. And it just gave me the power to do that. You said, do whatever I need. So I use the powers you gave me. That's this problem with general powers. But see, we didn't do that. When they created this contract to only do my grass, not even the edging, just mow, and mow to this very specific height, that's what our Constitution did. It was very, very specific. It didn't give general latitudes. So when you look at regulating commerce, when you want to redefine commerce, you actually have to go into how was it discussed? And they got into the details. Commerce among the states was basically to ensure that one state could not take advantage of other states. Well, how could one state take advantage? Actually, they expound upon this in Article 1, Section 10. Because they understood that states like New York and Virginia that had ports where the interior states like Indiana, Ohio, and so forth, they didn't have access to ports to ship their commerce out because they didn't have airplanes to ship out. So they knew that New York might play shenanigans and say, well, we're going to put a tax on all the goods that don't come into this state. So that's why they baked it into the Constitution that no state could create any tax, which is one of the reasons why no state can actually deny another state of the selling of their goods within that state. So what they did was they made sure that there was an even playing field. Now, if you live in Wyoming or you live in the very center of the United States, then it's going to cost you more money because of the cost of gas, but you shouldn't have to pay the toll fees to ingratiate, you know, where they're actually making money. So what they put in Article 1, Section 10 was that the states could actually put, you know, tolls or assessments that are reasonable for, you know, for compensation. In other words, the use of the port, the use of the throughput, the, you know, the wear and tear on the trails or the roads that they were using and so forth. And they denned it right there to make sure that the states couldn't create economic warfare. There was no way in heck a state had the authority based on the Commerce Clause to keep other states from being able to sell their cars because they didn't meet their emission standards. But that's exactly what California got away with. California started actually violating the Commerce Clause and say, we're not going to sell your cars unless you meet these standards. And then they got the federal government to actually usurp that authority and started running with it. And then next thing you know, we've got the CAFE standards coming out in the 1980s, the CAFE standards. And that actually caused more death than anything else. So when they started getting involved in our commerce, they were just the traffic court, just to make sure that states were playing fairly with each other. They didn't have the authority to actually regulate anything. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So when people, you know, because I know the Convention of State folks bring up, oh, we need to further define that. No, you don't want to do that. They defined it very well in the ratification debates. And it, the reason it was defined is because of Article 1, Section 10. It was about keeping sure, making sure that states did not, they played fairly and they did not try to go down economic warfare paths, so that they could ingratiate themselves over the disadvantage because they couldn't have a port. So I hope that answers your question. But, you know, as we start looking at all of these different clauses and how the courts constantly made these rules, back to what you were saying with the court, you look at the law, and the law is rigid, and it was defined in the ratification debates. What the court does is they put the law like a piece of lumber, and they soak it in wood, and they go, well, let's see how we can stretch this. Oh, mm-hmm. We can twist it this way, and then we can bend it that way. Yeah, and that meets our purpose. That meets exactly what, you know, this unconstitutional entity like the Commerce or the Department of Agriculture, you know, the Department of Commerce or the Department of Transportation. And lo and behold, they created a law that is outside their, because they don't even have the power to do it. And they make laws outside their jurisdiction. And this is how the creep and the growth is constantly gone. And as a matter of fact, this is why Madison stated in his report that one branch, just like the other, if one it gets away with usurping power, the others will do it as well. He was prophetic.
Before I lose this thought,
go ahead.
In the court system, these case decisions set precedent going forward. If we were to basically remove this foundation and tumble it down through republic review, would it also unbind all of those decisions and the precedents they set? Would that also unravel?
Yeah, so the first thing that would be established is the states never granted the federal government to apply precedents. In other words, see, a precedence isn't necessarily an outcome. It is a principle that had come from another case where somebody made this kind of argument, and now we can kind of apply that, like equal protection under the law. As equal protection under the law with the 14th Amendment was actually defined, it strictly was tied to ensuring that criminal law was equally applied. You know, so when somebody has, and it's not just the law, but like a right as well, that when somebody walks into a restaurant and there are chairs open, and the restaurant is open for the public, unless that's actually a hard reservation where they take reservations. Restaurants do that, folks. But if it's a diner where, you know, they just come on in and get something to eat, then every seat is available to any customer that walks in there. If they start creating a rule and asking the state to enforce this as a law by a particular person of one color, one race, or one sex, gender, or age, and they say, hey, look, you know, we want to, you know, sit right here, and this is where we're going to sit. And they say, no, you can't sit there because that's reserved, you know, only these types of people can sit there.
The people with the mask.
So that right there is a law that abridges the privileges and immunities, or it's a rule. And so what they have to do is, do they have their own police and they take you to their court, to the, you know, the McDonald's court down the street? If it's McDonald's? No. They call the police, the people that you're paying taxes for, and they ask the state to open up the court to prosecute you for violating the rules, for this civil disobedience, or, you know, violating these laws. And bottom line, the 14th Amendment is clear. No state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges or immunities of a U.S. citizen. So the Jim Crow laws, all of these laws that the court system put in water and twisted and bent, were all supporting unconstitutional law. And they furthered and actually enabled discrimination, and they caused this nation to basically grapple with, you know, a disease instead of allowing it to heal. Instead of being Christians and saying, you know, this is wrong, we have to do the right thing, and we're moving forward doing the right thing. And the radical Republicans did everything they could with the 14th Amendment and then the 15th Amendment to make it right. And that's why I say, when you really look at the, you know, what the radical Republicans were doing, the reason why everybody calls them radical and why that stuck is because we've taken the godless view, and we've kind of, okay, I'm okay with these problems. And everybody on, I would just say, those people that have been biased over the course of, you know, the century plus, a century and a half, you know, they've, oh yeah, the 14th Amendment, it's bad. I don't like this or I don't like that. And they haven't backed out, and they haven't really looked at what happened, what was going on, and the whole intent. You know, you probably knew and you probably heard on the show that Jefferson did everything he could when he realized that it would not be fair in America, because the way the biases had been so baked into our society because of what the king did. You know, the king of England was the one that dictated that all our slaves had to be black. And so there were some slaves, or I should say some black freemen, that were actually pulled into slavery. And some of them got back out because they proved that they, you know, they were actually a free person. And most people don't even know this, but only three states in the Union didn't allow blacks to vote. All the other states allowed blacks to vote. All of them, except for, I think, the two Carolinas and Georgia. Or maybe it was Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and maybe New Jersey. There were only three. And I wrote it in my article, Why Counties Matter Most. And why is this important? Because it wasn't until after the 1800s where they started suppressing the black vote by trying to add, you know, and change and manipulate the poll taxes for voting. I mean, poll taxes had been around for a long, long time. But they were fair, and everybody paid an equal amount. But they started playing with it, and that's when they finally got to a point where they outright banned blacks from voting. So you could see that the civil rights problem was actually occurring, and this is why Jefferson put it in a plan to actually buy an area. You know about this, right? Buy an area in Africa, to buy some land in Africa and repatriate the freemen back to Africa, those who want to go. Did you know that was his plan?
You know, I vaguely remember in college, in my American history, learning about something like that. She always had these sidebar stories that were very interesting that you don't normally hear.
Right. Because it doesn't fit the narrative. And today, if everybody knew that Jefferson had a plan to actually take dollars, you know, out of the federal funds to appropriate land, a territory, to give to the blacks, to allow them to repatriate back to Africa. Well, so what he did was he got the Louisiana territory, and he never got there because we were still being harassed by England. It wasn't until after Madison finally ended the harassment with England to where we could finally go, okay, now we don't have to look over our shoulder at this, you know, ratty, you know, tantrumous, you know, empire over here. And it was Monroe that actually executed the plan. All three of these guys were very close friends. And so Monroe basically executed. Madison kind of paved the way from what Jefferson wanted to do, and Monroe just took it on, and he was the one that actually got to execute it. That's why the nation, Liberia, was for liberty, and why the capital was named after Monroe, Monrovia.
Interesting. I'd not heard that.
Right. Now, you know, there's really good things that Monroe did, and there's some bad things that Monroe did. And I think he was trying to allow political compromise. So one of the things I had also, you know, I'm aware of is Jefferson, after he was the president, he started becoming a philosophical, you know, let it live type of thing. And he came up with some really interesting paradigms, like, you know, the earth belongs to the living. And some of this stuff is just absolutely brilliant. But some of the stuff, because he actually lent to more of a living constitution. He was thinking that maybe we should have a more living constitution to let populism just easily change it instead of the way it is. And I look today and say, yeah, had he lived long enough to see how it has just been changed and how it's been abused, it would take mm-hmm. him back to his 1798 paradigm in Kentucky that we cannot allow these things to be abused. I think he forgot that this was like in 1816. So it was like almost 20 years later when he right. started, you know, thinking, okay, maybe we can, because some of the things that would really help this country would actually, you know, require either getting amendments or just doing it. And maybe just doing it would be easier. And I don't think he realized that the real problem was Congress, that not just Congress, but the parties. Or there was this, as Madison states in 1821, he actually fingers and points to this secret society in our politics that was working adamantly, working and endeavoring to pervert our government, to take it back towards a monarchy or an aristocracy, both of which Britain has. If you look at the Parliament is an aristocracy. The House of Lords is nothing but an aristocracy. And obviously it's a part of a monarchy as well. So, I mean, people go, we kind of like that system. And there were people like Hamilton and others. And mm-hmm. so Madison kind of pointed out in this letter to John G. Jackson, which we talked about last week, literally, he says, look, there were these secret, you know, actions being done by, you know, people that wanted to actually change our government back to a monarchy or an aristocracy. And I don't think anybody knew that. I don't think that people knew how close we could have gotten had Jefferson and Madison not successfully had their revolution. So back to the courts, though. What should happen is when something comes along, like when the court says, hey, you know, we... it's a lawyer. It starts at the source sometimes. The real problem is when we see the separate but equal or some of these law cases, there's a person that walks straight into the federal court and they say, I want to have this case. And instead of actually applying jurisdiction, the federal court just sucks it up and says, absolutely, bring your money. Mm-hmm. And they just rub their hands, they rub their, you know, their dirty, you know, mitts, and they say, yeah, you know, bring it on. We'll have the circus here and just, you know, we'll schedule it and we'll make money on it. And that's what they do. So what should actually happen? And I've actually, so I'm going to, you know, open this little veil behind me here so that you can kind of have a peek. We are supposed to have a representative government. And the one part of, because the way we choose the president by the Electoral College is truly a representative government. Our Congress, if we're actually restore the 17th Amendment, is truly a representative government of the sovereigns. It's both we the people and of the sovereigns. And that's the same thing with the president, vice president. We do not have representation in the Supreme Court. And so I believe that each state should choose their own justice that would sit on the Supreme Court, and it would no longer be a lifetime, because it has only been proven that they have this, once they have this thing called tenure, just like a professor, mm-hmm. they have this, oh, I've got this security now, right. And I can get away with doing anything I want. And as long as I make it seem believable, and how many judges who have actually done bad things have ever been called out and removed?
Right.
I don't know of any case where a judge has actually been removed, maybe except one. And we've had all sorts of judges outright. I mean, I think one was so sick they couldn't even actually be a jurist, and they should have been removed, and they never did. So I see it as we should actually probably make it maybe an 8-year term so that it can survive, or a 6 or an odd number. So
across the board.
But it would, yes, but if you look at it, if we have 50 judges And in other words, each state has one judge in the Supreme Court. Then what it does is it breaks up the court from sitting in D.C. It forces them into a virtual space and allows them to basically distribute the cases so people don't have to travel to D.C. They can either travel to these districts or what have you. And if it requires the full, you know, if it goes up to the full bar, or I should say the full a magnitude of the court, all 50 judges would then weigh in on the case by voting, and that the Supreme Court justices would be appointed by the president. And if we have 51 judges or 51 states, so 51 judges, then the president would have the latitude of being able to appoint a second alternate or an assistant Supreme Court justice or chief justice, assistant chief. And that way we would always have a tiebreaker, but we would have representation, and we will actually start seeing the makeup of the court no longer being the Ivy League, would actually see judges that would have never stepped in an Ivy League classroom, that have been brought up by their own local law education and so forth, and common law, and actually embrace common law again.
We are at less than 10 minutes.
Yeah,
we're going on 8 minutes.
Okay.
Before we go today, one of the things I wanted to get in before we leave is the sovereign citizen movement, because that is what got me to contact you.
Sure.
When I found out some information, and I agree with these people that they see that there's infractions, and their way of doing this is the way they're solving it is just to remove themselves from the system.
Right.
So what is your opinion on that? Why or why not do you agree with that?
Okay. So they're being driven by the exact same problem as the convention of states, all these conservative groups out there, they're all agreeing that the government is behaving badly and that we need to do something. Now, there are myopic organizations like anti-abortion. The sovereign citizen is, I would just say, a myopic organization because, you know, hey, here's a path to not have to pay taxes. And to be honest with you, I think that's the greatest lure for most people. Hmm. When they realize, I mean, I can tell you, it would be a huge win, you know, a windfall of more money in my pocket if I stopped, you know, and went down that path. But the reality is that we have to actually talk about what is the right course. Because I look at this, if we all sit at the table and talk about, is this constitutional? We'll all agree that these things are not constitutional. Nobody could argue and refute that our debt is constitutional. It's not. Nobody can refute all of these assertions, and most all of us are making these. I mean, some aren't as far, you know, into our camp yet, because there's like Hillsdale College that actually accepts, you know, the Department of Transportation. They don't challenge those things. They actually still embrace this court paradigm that, you know, the law can be bent and stretched, you know, if necessary. And I don't. The Constitution wasn't allowed. There's nothing in the Constitution that allows case law or precedents to be involved at all. You want to change something, it requires an amendment. You can't redefine how that was defined. This is the natural born citizen. You cannot change that unless you come to the states and we will redefine it, because we are the principal parties. So when everybody hears all of this, they're like, oh, yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, we can't argue that. That all falls within the fundamental tenets and the nature of compacts and contract law. So as we sit there and we say, well, what is the process? This is where I think we have to have this debate. Is the sovereign citizen process, does that really solve the problem? Does that solve the problem and get our government into compliance? No. As a matter of fact, the more people that do that, and if everybody did that, then the government would be able to just swoop in and do all sorts of atrocities. Because the more people that, you know, aren't citizens, they can quickly, because the reality is, who is protected by the U.S. Constitution? When the 14th Amendment says that the state shall make no law or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of people of the world? No. U.S. citizens. So if you step out of being a U.S. citizen, then you've actually jumped into from the frying pan into the fire. There's nothing protecting you. And so we can easily take this frying pan back and put it back into the cooler, but we have to force the federal government into compliance. And walking out that door and becoming a sovereign person does not force the federal government into doing anything. The Convention of States doesn't do that. So that presentation that I'll be giving, that I gave you, actually really identifies this. So, you know, we actually have to have a real open and honest conversation. This is why I include in there on page 4, I actually have the 12 pictures of, no, it's the 10 pictures of the color-coded Constitution from Article 1 to Article 7. And I let people see it at a macro view, looking at all 10 pages at once, they can see how much color, how much violations is being done to the Constitution. And I say, those are real problems that we have to fix. If not, we're going off this cliff. But it doesn't end there. The next page are all of these powers that have been created that they didn't have the authority to do. Those are absolutely, they're indirect violations, but they're just as egregious as well. The Environmental Protection Agency and all these other things that aren't even included in that list. All of these assumed powers must be addressed. And only the states have the authority to do this. This is exactly what we've been saying and proving through this. So the next step is, well, does it end there? No, it doesn't end there. Now we actually have to start looking at like we just talked about, the court cases. How many times has the court overreached their bounds and actually stepped in and said, look, we're going to go ahead and twist the law and bend it because that's how we're going to get this board to fit. Because it's about making these things work and fit, because that's what we want to do. Where this is not their compact. They are there to do a very specific job, and they've convinced us that they're the king. When the law is the king, in a republican form of government, the law is king. Not the president, not Congress, not that federal government. The federal government is a servicing agency. We don't even have a federation. If you really look, and this is one of the reasons why I tell people, stop calling us a constitutional republic. In light of, contrary to a democracy, but that does not actually delineate what we are. We're a hybrid constitutional republic. Every nation in the world is a constitutional republic. Even communist China is a constitutional republic. So what's different between us? We have three levels of republics, or I should say we have three tiers of our government. We have a general government in the federal government. We should have a general government in the state, and then we have a local government where all the power resides. So in other words, this is not a simple, as a matter of fact, you have to define when you look at the republic, is the republic a democracy? Is the republic a confederation? Is it a monarchy? Is it a federation? Every constitutional republic out there, practically, they're all federations. And a federation is where the most all power has been given to that federal or the general government. They have the discernment to decide. A confederation is where very limited powers are actually granted to the general government, and the residual powers remain with the states. So we actually have a confederation. We do not have a federal government. If you start looking at all of these definitions, why is it that so many people on the conservative side are yelling federalism, federalism? By that term right there, it basically says that they have most all the powers when they don't. See, we've actually, this language, because nobody's heard of confederalism. Go look it up. It's actually a word. Confederalism is the idea of maintaining power separate from your general government. And if we actually started talking right and we started understanding, it just makes life so much easier to recognize what the solution is. I truly believe if we really sat down and we started arguing, or not arguing, but discussing openly and honestly, what is the real problem? Everybody would say, if we're here to solve the problem, these guys going out the door and becoming sovereign citizens, or these guys saying single state nullification, or these guys calling for an amendment, they're not going to get there. So hopefully that answers your question. I know this is going to cut out on you, so I apologize. But bottom line is what we're trying to do here is we're trying to get the discussion to happen. And as a matter of fact, hopefully you can still hear this. I hope that you become the advocate to actually calling for this real discussion that America has to have first before people start choosing to go out the door. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.